This is the podcast for Wednesday, February 22nd, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. Today we start on belief and will. So, let's see, we have an exam that's ongoing, right? And it closes Thursday, 7 p.m., which is tomorrow. Right, so make sure to get in there and take it. If you need an extension, please send me a Moodle message. Lots of deadlines coming up these next couple of weeks. So the deadline for the exam is this Thursday, tomorrow, the 23rd. And then the following Friday is the last opportunity to change your grading option or drop the class. And here, Elaine, someone correct me if I'm wrong. You can wait up until that magic deadline of Friday, 5 p.m., end of the eighth week, and no one will ever know you took the course, you know, unless you're on the podcast or something. There's no like notation in your transcript if you withdraw. Is that correct? Anybody know? Is there a W or something, or what do you see?
You see in the class and then like an asterisk. So.
They'll show like an asterisk or something.
Yeah.
Withdrew it from the class.
With what?
Yeah. They show you withdrew
it
from
the name of the class and then like an asterisk. So.
An asterisk.
Yeah, just something that shows up.
I think it does show up.
It shows up?
It does.
But I don't know what it shows up.
Does anybody else besides people at Lane know what an asterisk mean?
Like a sign, you know?
Asterisk.
Right.
No, he knows what the sign is.
I'm just saying, does anybody else know what, like, if I were, like, making transcripts, I would put an asterisk next to classes. Like, is there an asterisk next to where the grade's supposed to be?
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, withdraws a negative mark on your grade.
Is there any like notation at the bottom that says withdrew from class? Okay.
No.
Okay. So it will show up there. So actually, but you know, it's better than an F. It's better than a no pass.
It doesn't affect your GPA.
It doesn't affect your GPA. Right. And you get one or two of those in your transcript, nobody's going to care. If every term you've got like two or three, you know, withdrew after the deadline. Now, the first week you can drop and nobody's going to know it's there. But after that first week deadline, when you're actually paying for the class, it'll show that you're there. So so make sure to make those decisions. And to help you, they're doing some more workshops. So I posted, or I haven't posted it yet, but I will post lots of postings. I will post this on the course, but you know, where is it? Making Wise Choices workshops. So they'll be going on. Sometimes they even have those in here. Wait for it to come up. Let's see. Tuesday, February 28th, 2:30 to 3:20. So these are all 50-minute workshops. So Tuesday, February 28th to 2:30. Building 30, room 213. So, I'm just going to call these Making Wise Choices. Sounds like a personal encounter or development workshop or something. They call it like add, drop, break, change, schedule change workshop. Drop, grade option workshops. Oh, there it is. So Tuesday, 2:28, 3:30. That's the room number, building 30. So Tuesday, February 28th, 2:30, building 30, room 213. Wednesday, the 29th, 1 to 220. The 1 o'clock, is that longer? That's an hour and 20 minutes. In a second. Maybe I should need to put that there. 2:30. 3:20.
Wednesday, 2:29. This is 1 to 2:20 in building 30, room 114. And then they're doing one Thursday, March 1st, the day before, for all the last minute people. And that's going to be 1 to 1:50. This is going to be in building 19, room 234. So these are good. I've been being peppered with questions about if I drop now, will it change my, will it affect my grade? Can I get an incomplete? What's a no, what's pass, no pass? What's a no credit? And you know, all these questions that I just like, obviously don't know, since I thought that you could just drop and there'd be no notation whatsoever. It seemed weird. I actually asked, is that like, has it always been that way? Yeah.
Well, for 2 years. I've been here 2 years.
Because I had
somebody tell me at some point that there was no notation. I think it was a faculty member who may have been misinformed. But anyway, sorry, question.
I'm not entirely sure on this, but doesn't it affect your financial aid?
Yeah, I think that's why it stays on there.
So there's probably some minimum, there's some minimum amount you need to get financial aid. So if you drop below that threshold, then you're not going to get, you might have to like pay some money back. So, I mean, there's all sorts of, it can get complicated, which is why if you have questions, you should go to this workshop. If you're thinking about dropping, you're thinking about taking class pass, no pass. The other thing to consider is, well, actually, this won't affect you because you'll be taking the exam by Thursday. So if you ask for an extension, you should try to take the exam before you go to the workshop, because then you kind of know where you stand. And by the way, if you're interested in calculating your grade, Moodle is kind of complicated. You can do a running total, but you have to wait for all the exams to be done. I have makeup sitting out there, and then I have to go and put zeros in the blank ones, and it can get complicated to do a running total. So the total is sort of, the total column, I have it hidden, or it's showing like what you've done so far. But you can calculate your grade anytime. Just look at your exam scores, and it's first midterm plus.
Is that room or building 30?
Building 30. So that's like the new, that's a new swanky building behind like the health building. Sort of out by where that you can go to be experimented on by dental students.
Only the nursing,
but it's sort of out in that direction,
yeah.
Kind of by the clock tower.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like that brand new building with like the swanky coffee bar and you know the nice seats.
Don't get on the coffee bar.
That's an overly efficient.
No, I'm not criticizing at all. I'm saying that's like it's kind of ritzy over there. It's like I never get over there except for once a month we have a curriculum meeting and I go over there and like. Wow, this is like really nice. I'm still stuck in the crappy center building with the drinking fountain that doesn't even have a refrigeration unit and one stall toilet and you know the heat's always off and the carpet's kind of ratty looking. Anyway.
But that's how you perceive it.
If God closes his eyes, does he go away?
Right.
It's an objective reality. Although I suppose you know compared to what right. Sometimes you know, I suppose this
rice paddy.
This is actually a newer room, with nice chic red brick.
And the prison cool light. Water.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
On the social forum, is that what you posted on there?
No, I posted a couple other things. I didn't get to that one. I had to run down to class. I was like posting stuff and trying to catch up, and I'm like, oh, I got to teach. but I'll post that up there right away, and I'll post that. Actually, I'm going to post that in the announcements, I think, just to send it off to everybody and remind them about the deadline. So I got some other stuff coming up. There's the Philosophy Club's meeting Monday, March 5th. I'll have a flyer next week. Monday, March 5th, 7 to 8. So pretty short meeting. You know, we don't want to, like, give people a big time commitment they can't meet.
it's a good, Monday's a good time. You sort of back to school, and Monday it's sort of a ghost town on campus here, so it's a good time to use the cafeteria. And it's going to be an artificial intelligence. And then we have a Sufi guy coming on March 8th.
A what guy?
Sufi. Sufi scholar. So, and I may have posted that already, or if I haven't, I will shortly.
What's his name?
I'm trying to remember offhand here. What's his name? Just here.
What's exactly a Sufi scholar?
So Sufism is a mystical branch of Islam.
Ooh, and dervish.
The dervish are a subsect of the Sufis. So all dervishes are Sufis, but not all Sufis are dervishes. Irfan Omar. And he's a renowned scholar. He's on the steering committee for the American Academy of Religion. And he's going to be talking about mysticism. He'll be talking about a classic mystical poetry text, probably the most famous Sufi text, called the... I don't want to misquote it. Not the... No, it's the one about the birds, the conference of birds. I was going to call it the Confederation of Birds. It's confusing with the Confederation of Dunces. No, it's the Confederation of Birds. And then he'll also be talking about interfaith dialogue. There's a famous case where St. Francis of Assisi met this a Muslim, and the two talk together, and he calls this the dialogue of the heart. So it's all about interfaith dialogue, getting to understand people of different faith traditions, and you know, from the Sufi point of view, understanding the unity which underlies all religion and the spiritual reality behind it. So as part of our Islamic Scholar Series, and that will be Thursday, March 8th. Which I think, is that the last day of finals week?
No.
It's week nine. No, this is... week nine, I guess. I don't know. I'm just. I probably have spring break on the brain here.
Okay. Finals week is the 19th through the 24th.
Okay. Yes, this would be like week nine. Okay. So March. Thursday. And this will be 1 to 2:30 and 5 to 6:30. It's in the Center for Meaning and Learning. I'm not sure what the room number is, but it'll be on the flyer. Okay. Oh, I just got it right here. Might as well stick that up there while I'm at it, and then move on talking about belief and will. 226. Center for Meaning and Learning is also known as Building 19. Okay. And that's it for announcements. Okay. Let's talk about belief and will. And we start out with W.K. Clifford. This essay, The Ethics of Belief, is a kind of classic in philosophy, in free thinker literature, in critical thinking, and the sort of the skeptic community. And here he talks about your duties with regard to what you believe. And he opens up with this example of the ship owner. So what... When you read this example, what's Clifford getting at? Tell me, what is the example about? What happens in the story he tells about the ship owner? And again, from the diaphragm. What's the deal with the ship owner? I don't know if you're still studying for the exam. And anybody who's read this?
The ship owner is concerned about a ship he has that's going out.
A little louder. You're way in the back, the farthest back you can be.
There's a ship owner, and he's got a ship going out, and he is concerned about the ship itself and whether or not it'll make it. And instead of getting the ship checked out or doing anything about it, he just stifles his own doubts about it so that he will feel better. And he ends the story with the ship sinking, and then goes back and says, well, what if the ship hadn't sank and everybody made it fine? And it's not necessarily whether or not the ship sank or not, it's his stifling his own doubts without seeking any real truth in the matter.
There you go. So, and what penalty does the ship owner himself have to pay for his error in judgment? Anybody remember? Does he lose his shirt because it's his ship and now all his investment is gone? Oh no, he had it insured. So he collects insurance money and he's no worse the wearer. His passengers who are looking for a better life in America, on the other hand, are all, and the crew, are all at the bottom of the sea. And so their lives didn't turn out so well. And I think maybe a kind of a secondary point is that when people fail to think critically and make good judgments and act accordingly, or don't act in this case, that often it's not the person who with the poor judgment, but it's the people around them that suffer the consequences. And sometimes people who make poor decisions manage to escape those consequences. So, but what's his basic point? So he's got this ship, and he kind of knows in the back of his mind that maybe it's not in such great shape. Maybe it'd be a good idea to inspect it. It's kind of this old rust bucket of a ship. But what does he do when he starts to wonder, well, I wonder if I should, like, you know, have it sit in port for a while, forego the extra income I get of sending it out again without looking at it. And what does he do when he starts to wonder? Yeah.
He actually uses the persistence of nature to, like, because everything, today is going to be the same as it was yesterday, kind of argument, to coax him or to make himself feel better.
Yeah, the way Clifford puts it, he says, this old sturdy ship has lasted many a journey and it will continue to do so. And how does Clifford describe that sort of attitude? He used a particular word for this. He has in his that his ship will continue on. Faith. He has faith that his ship will continue on as it had before. Now, by faith, Clifford means belief without evidence, or belief without sufficient evidence. So he has faith in his ship, but he also has doubt that the ship might not make it. What does he do with the doubt? When you're a person of great faith and you have doubts, what's the usual thing that people will do? What's human nature? Suppress them, right? Push them down. Oh, I don't want to think about that, right? I don't think about maybe that guy from Nigeria that I just gave my bank routing information to isn't really a minor noble and isn't going to send me $10 million and deposit in my bank account. Maybe I should go check it right now. Maybe I should call my bank because my bank account's about to be drained. Oh, but that's just so bothers me to think about so much. It would be so terrible. I'm just going to push it out of my mind and look, think about the riches that I'll have and be able to retire from a grueling job teaching at Lane Community College and finally get my villa in Costa Rica, right? So this is the same sort of attitude he has. Well, he has faith, and he suppresses his doubts, and he doesn't use evidence to try to verify his belief that his ship will make the journey safely. And the result is the ship is lost in all hands, and all the passengers and everybody dies, and it's really bad, and it's all this guy's fault. And so what's the lesson Clifford says that we would take from this? What's his point about this example?
Wasn't it something about neglect and that is willful and immoral behavior?
Yeah, neglect is just as bad as willful behavior. And that's a good point that in this case,
it's not like what you do, but it's what you fail to do. And that he is still responsible, because if he had inspected the ship, then it wouldn't have sunk. So it's this negligence. And he also, by the way, he says that the case, would the ship owner be any less guilty if the ship didn't sink?
No.
Yeah, he says no. And what do you think about that idea?
There's still some kind of risk, though.
I think he'd be just as guilty, but he wouldn't know it.
Yeah, think about it. You ever heard anybody say, every once in a while I'm at the bar and, you know, I don't want to call a cab. It's so expensive and my car is right there and I have to come back and get it the next day. So maybe I had a few too many. I drive slow and, keep to my regular route and look out for cops and it's fine. And I haven't gotten in a wreck yet. The other day, though, you know, I woke up, and I was like pulled off on the side of the road and like in the brush, and I was really glad the cops didn't come by because I kind of messed up my front end a little bit, but at least I didn't hit anybody. So, but you know, next time I'm out there drinking, maybe I'll take a cab, but maybe I'll just try to be a little more careful. Yeah. So that you look at a person like that and you think, well, even though you haven't killed anybody yet, you're doing something that's really dangerous and endangering the lives of people around you. You've just sort of been lucky. You've been lucky that nothing bad has happened to you. And this is the same thing with drunk drivers. This is a good example of what Clifford's talking about. Often the drunk driver is so sort of loose and limber that if he gets in an accident, he kind of bounces around like a rag doll, and it's his passengers or innocent bystanders who are killed.
Isn't he really talking about the person at the bar that sees someone drive off and knows that they're dead? Isn't he really saying, you know, it's their fault for not taking that extra step to protect society, to do something, whether it's call the police, take the keys from the person or whatever, because they're sending them out into the world, or they're watching them go out into the world and realizing that there's danger, but they're not acting upon it, they're suppressing their responsibility.
Well, I think it could apply to either person, probably. Either the person who's actually drinking, or the person who's drinking or see someone drunk and see someone leave a bar and about to get in a car and drive home. And this, if we follow this analogy through, the drunk driving analogy, you might see it as a difference between spouting off nonsense and to other people, like about how, suppose, for example, here's another similar example. You say, "Oh, I don't believe in that. The modern medical idea, cut it, you know, cancer treatment, cut it out, burn it out. You know, I think that you should, believe in the power of the mind to heal yourself, and eat like, you know, go on like a macrobiotic diet, and cut out all the sugar and the fat and all the toxins and the yellow number 5 and all those things that give people cancer, and like meditate every day and that cancer will just go away." I heard that on like the Coast to Coast AM with George Norris, some woman that she just like ate like a macrobiotic diet and prayed and she got better. And so if I ever get cancer, that's what I'm going to do. And suppose the person you're talking to gets the cancer, right? And they follow your advice, and when they, like Steve Jobs, they end up waiting too late for treatment and end up dying. Yeah.
So isn't it like the parents in Oregon that just ended up killing their son because they believed it was against their religious beliefs and he had some cold or something that they thought religious beliefs would heal, and he ended up dying when he could have gone to the doctor and lived, and now they were just sent to prison because they could have cured him?
Right, he had like some sort of like serious pneumonia or something like that.
Yeah.
But it could have been cured had they just gone to the doctor, but they said it was against their religious beliefs.
Speaking of faith healing, different as well.
Yeah, so that'd be another example. I think about like if you're in the bar and you're spouting off your theory about faith healing or about like eating, you know,
Mexican yams or whatever, or shark cartilage to cure cancer, because you heard it on Coast to Coast AM. Some guy selling the book is, or just the wants to be on the radio is like spouting out this crazy stuff, and you're just repeating it. You haven't checked it out. You haven't looked at any of the studies, and you're just sort of spraying this around. What he says, what Clifford says, is you're sort of like Typhoid Mary stirring the pot, you know, giving your fever to everybody that partakes. You're kind of spewing out this nonsense, and you're just like a plague victim walking down the street and contaminating everything he touches and every person he comes in contact with. If you're spreading superstitious beliefs, unfounded beliefs, crazy conspiracy theories, quack health theories, you're causing damage to people because you're giving credence to all those beliefs, according to Clifford. Yeah.
Isn't this how most religions started, though? Where somebody gets this supposed kooky idea that there's a malevolent being that's watching over all of us and has our benefit and our goodwill in mind. And then so many of a collective starts to bite onto the same idea and creates a religion.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons the way religion spread. I think you're right about that. And it might be that it starts out somebody has some mystical experience, and it might be they're eating some funny mushrooms. It might be that they got something wrong with their brain, and they have these sort of visions. I won't say, it's sort of begging the question. We'll talk about religious knowledge later to say that all religions are based in, you know, superstitious nonsense. But I think you can think of particular religious beliefs which you would categorize as superstitious, like the cargo cults, or people who are like believe in lucky numbers, or that it's bad luck to step on a crack in the sidewalk, or that you should throw salt over your shoulder if you spill it, or people that believe in curses and the evil eye and things like that. Most people, even people that are religious and have some sort of religious faith, will see those things as sort of lacking evidence, not something that a rational person would accept. Let's come back to Clifford's point, because I'm kind of getting a little ahead of myself as far as like your duty to other peoples and sort of spreading beliefs. But what's his main point here about your duties about believing? Okay, here I'll give you a little help here. Page 164. Clifford sums up his entire article. To sum up, it is wrong always, everywhere, for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. I'll read this again. It's wrong always, everywhere, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. And that's what he's getting at with the ship owner example. What was wrong with what the ship owner did? It's that he believed his ship would make its journey safely without sufficient evidence. And what happened as a result? The belief turned out to be false, and disastrous consequences followed. And Clifford thinks that anytime you base a belief on insufficient evidence, you're taking your life in your hands, or maybe the lives of other people. And even though it might seem that in this particular case you can have your quirky little belief and sort of, you know, feel the giddy excitement of believing something strange and wonderful, but what you're doing is you're getting people to fall into lazy, sloppy habits of you know, making decisions based on what would be cool if it were true, or what seems neato and awesome, instead of thinking, oh, come on, do you really take that seriously? And, hey, is there any evidence for that? He gives another example here to push home his point. And this is the baseless rumor. So what's the deal with the baseless rumor? This is like this small island community, and there's a rumor going around. What's the rumor about? This might be kind of archaic example that anybody would care about this. So it's about this religious cult, and this is kind of the baseless rumor. It's about a religious cult, and in this religious cult, they don't believe in the big thing. They don't believe in original sin or hell. And at the time, not believing those things is seen as like being scandalous. Yeah. You're going to say that? Oh, you didn't have your hand up. You were stretching. Okay. So this religious sect on the small island community, and the rumor is, well, okay, it's true that this group doesn't believe in original sin or hell. But there's this rumor that they're going out and abducting people's children and like taking them to their cult meeting and try to get them to not believe in original sin and eternal torment. And so people get upset about this this group, and they end up being persecuted. And what Clifford says is that what would be wrong about what's wrong about this is people are following a baseless rumor. And it would be wrong to act on the rumor even if it were true. Because even though it's true, you don't know it to be true. And if you get in the habit of acting on baseless rumors, it's going to lead to bad consequences. So in both these cases, believing with insufficient evidence is something which is likely to lead to bad consequences. But there's something else wrong with it besides the bad consequences. Let me put that up here. So
believing without sufficient evidence. Now, sufficient for what? Sufficient to justify the belief.
You know, such that any rational person would accept the belief as true. Or you can talk about the preponderance of evidence. Not necessarily belief beyond reasonable doubt, but belief, you know, enough evidence that it makes the proposition extremely likely to be true. So believing without sufficient evidence, sufficient to justify a belief, is wrong because, you know, it is likely to lead to bad consequences. And then there's a second reason here. He actually says, besides the bad consequences, it's wrong because I suppose you'd say it's wrong in itself. So, this is not that grammatical. The two ways in which it's wrong because it leads to bad consequences, or is likely to do so, and then it's just wrong in itself. And it's wrong in itself, he talks about the fact that it disrespects reason, science, human knowledge, achievement. I think Clifford thinks that if your child has a preventable disease and you're praying for some God to heal your child, when just down the street there's a modern building with the counters full of all sorts of pills which will make that disease go away, antibiotics, there's and all sorts of medical equipment in case your son or daughter goes into acute respiratory distress. They've got resuscitation things in case your kid dies, they can bring him back to life. And all this wonderful technology that goes back, you know, thousands of years back to Hippocrates. It's been building up over the centuries, but, you know, the progress of science. And now today, things which would just wipe out people and your kid would just be dead, you could just take them down the street, you know, show them the insurance card. And even here in America, you know, no insurance, no problem, right? So your kid gets treated. If it's a serious emergency, your kid gets treated for free. And what do? Oh, no, you want to, like, you try to appease the angry gods or beg God to save your child and totally ignore all medical science. Or, you know, even worse, you have your, you know, have a witch doctor come over and put on the Ooga Booga mask and like burn some incense, and you know, and you're doing all this stuff that's like from the Stone Age culture, and ignoring modern medical science based on reason. And he thinks that when you're doing that, you're spitting in the face of every scientist that ever lived. And it's, you're disrespecting your own rational faculty by following superstition, which is, you know, belief without evidence, as opposed to reason and science. And so that's his point about that. He has a great sort of rant here. See if I can find this. This bit when he talks about the stain that can never be wiped away. Oh, here it is. It's on page 162, this big paragraph at the bottom. Let's see. It's right in the middle of the page. In the middle of this big paragraph at the bottom on 162. Belief, that sacred faculty which prompts the decisions of our will and knits into harmonious working all the compacted energies of our being, is ours not for ourselves, but for humanity. It is rightly used on truths which have been established by long experience and wanting toil, and which have stood in the fierce light of free and fearless questioning. So, you know, scientific method, it's, you know, somebody comes up with an experiment and they have some new result, and then everybody tries to disprove it or you know, verify. They do an experiment to see whether they agree with it. They and every time someone comes up with a new theory or hypothesis, it's, you know, peppered with questions and critical examination. That's the scientific method. As opposed to religion, where some guy says, you know, God told me X, and then people say, praise God, we have a revelation, and then it gets written down to a book, and then the people in charge of the book say the most important thing is that nothing in this book has ever changed. The scientific method, on the other hand, is self-correcting. So even if you have like a kooky theory like phlogiston, which was a medieval theory about what caused the ashes to weigh less than the wood after it was done burning. And the idea there was this stuff called phlogiston that mixed with the wood and had negative weight. You know, after a while, people said, "Oh, it's a stupid theory." And this theory of combustion makes much more sense, accounts for the data much better. People moved to that. We went from the idea that the Earth was stationary in the center of the universe to understanding that it revolved around the sun, and so on. So even though science at one time, going back to Aristotle says the Earth is stationary and the planets revolve around it, through the scientific method, you make adjustments and you figure out that's not the case. Not so with religion or faith. Then he says, then it helps to bind men together and to strengthen and direct their common action. It is desecrated when given to unproved and unquestioned assumptions for the solace and private pleasure of the believer, and to add tinsel splendor to the plain straight road of life and bright mirage beyond it. So, and again, I think about like if you're you're watching like YouTube videos about dark conspiracy theories, I get these from students all the time, and they say, oh, you know, the reptile men are running the world, or the Illuminati, or 9/11 was an inside job, and all this kooky stuff, and they didn't really examine it. They just watched the video and they believe it, and they believe everything they read on the internet. There's an old Chinese proverb that says, "Believe everything you say, believe everything you read, better not read." So, and you think about this, when the stuff's kind of cool and neat, I'm just like the next person, I find it really interesting. I'm reading a book right now on past life regression, and it's called Many Lives, Many Masters, offered by a student of mine, or a relative of the student. And it's really interesting, but I look at like the proof that it offers, and it's kind of thin, but I'm only halfway through the book, so... I'm going to give it a chance. I'm going to keep an open mind. But the idea is that I'll say, ooh, it'd be really cool to believe that I would have, like, many lives. I find it very pleasant to believe it. Or it'd be great to think that I'm part alien. or something, and you like, there's this guy Brad Steiger that writes all these crazy New Age books, and he's got one. It's called Star Child or something like that. Yeah. You take this personality quiz to see whether or not you could be like descended from an alien. And it's kind of cool to think you might be descended from an alien, or that, you know, you might be able to control the universe with the power of your mind, or there might have been a lost continent of Atlantis where they had powers of levitation, advanced technology. And you think of all this stuff. But then the question is there any evidence for that? You might find it comforting to think there's a Heavenly Father who looks out over your shoulder, and that everything happens for a reason. But again, you come back to this question. Clifford would say, is there really any evidence for that? And he said, you should only believe in those things if you have sufficient evidence, if you can prove them. So let me finish this long sentence here. Let's see. It is desecrated when given to unproved and unquestioned assumptions for the solace and private pleasure of a believer to add tinsel splendor to the straight, to the plain straight road of our life, and display a bright mirage beyond it, or even to drown the common sorrows of our kind by a self-deception which allows them not only to cast down but also degrade us. And you know, it's also, you get really depressed, somebody dies, things aren't going right, you tell yourself, oh, God, when God closes one door, He opens another. Mm-hmm. Or you see like you see like the tabloid newspaper, and it says, JonBenet is in heaven now. And there's a quote from Patsy Ramsey, her mother. JonBenet Ramsey was this 5-year-old beauty pageant girl that was garroted and killed, possibly by one or the other of her parents. And it's a really sad story. So just think about like if the person like in the Inquirer, you know, what would be a better headline? Well, how about like, you know, or what would be a more accurate headline? I think Clifford might say, you know, something like, JonBenet's corpse is being eaten by worms, right? That's not as cheery as JonBenet is in heaven now. You tell yourself JonBenet is in heaven now when your 5-year-old girl is dead, assuming you haven't killed her yourself, right? And it like makes you, assuming the Ramses are falsely, you know, wrongly accused, you tell yourself, oh, my daughter's in heaven now, and you feel kind of good. If you say, my daughter's corpse is being eaten by worms, it's kind of, that makes you kind of depressed, right? So, but if you think she's in heaven, the question is there any evidence for heaven? Let's see. So that's what he means by drowning your sorrow in self-deception. Whoso would deserve well of his fellows in this matter will guard the purity of belief with a very fanaticism of jealous care, lest at any time it should rest upon an unworthy object and cast a stain which could never be wiped away. So you know, once you make that post on your Facebook blog on ancient astronauts, you know, that's never going away. And you know, to your eternal shame, that people were like, hey, you know, that remember when you were like into the ancient astronaut theory, and then hang your head in shame, and you're like, oh, I should have known better. But now it's going to haunt me for the rest of my life. You know, like Newt's open marriage proposition. You know, it's just always going to be out there, and that's what people are going to think of. Yeah.
So, you know, like, I can definitely agree that you need substantial evidence to base and found your beliefs, without a doubt. But we also have to take into consideration that most of the ancient literary texts were destroyed by wars in constant conflict around the countries. Case in point, the Leaning Tower of Pisa used to be a library, you know? Or these ancient libraries that were literally meccas of information were burned because they were contrary to the belief system, or the aspiring belief system at the time. So how do we, as critical thinkers who want to found a belief on these things that may, in our common age, seem unfounded, have belief systems and search for this information, but still have the majority of our peers consider us kooky, if you will, but still have no information to back us up, even though that information may have been burned?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. And there might be some question about how much stake you put in ancient text. And there might be some question about, like, whether if you had a high material culture, like, say, existing 50,000 years ago, would you expect, you know, any artifacts to be left? You'd think, you know, generally speaking, like, if people are using... if they have a high material culture, they're going to be using metal alloys, they'll be using stuff that sort of sticks around, and or there'll be fossil record, or there'll be some sign, and not just somebody, you know, writing in the book like thousands of years later that says 50,000 years ago the gods were with us and they, you know, ruled from the heavens and yada yada. So and I should be clear here too that Clifford isn't necessarily saying that trying to give you any set of beliefs that you have to sort of subscribe to. He's just saying that whatever so he's not making a prejudgment of the facts of any case. And I'm giving examples of things that I think lack sufficient evidence. You could fill in your own. But he says if you have a belief, it should be based on sufficient evidence. Otherwise, you should withhold judgment on it. So that's all. That's all he's saying here. Yeah.
It seems like he's just simply saying if you want to know something, you need to know the opposite side of the story to be able to highlight it against to actually have something to compare against.
Yeah, they should. You should
know the argument.
Well, not just know the other side, but if you know the other side has good arguments against your view, then you shouldn't. Shouldn't accept your view. If you see, for example, if you see there's a whole bunch of contrary evidence to it, like, for example, you believe that J.B. Ryan established the power of ESP when he was working at Duke University, and you've, like, read a bunch of stuff on ESP and talked about these Zenon cards. I'm trying to remember that there's another guy he was working with whose name starts with a Z. And I can't think of it at the moment. But he's got these cards. You've probably seen them. One has wavy lines. The other one has like a triangle, right? There's like five basic cards. And people would try to guess. They have a 1-in-5 chance. And you look back at them, and they actually have some of these cards. You can see like the early cards, they're made of this like translucent material. So you hold them up, and you got a light behind you. You can like sort of see through the card and make out the shape. And he was oblivious to this fact. And you look back at the details of the experiment, and there's just all sorts of experimental errors. But usually people say, J.B. Ryan, Duke University, ESP stories, or ESP ESP experiments, and he got amazing results. And they've read it probably in like a pro ESP book. They haven't read any of the skeptical books. So I think what he would say is that you need to know the other side, and then not just to say, well, I've read the other side, but if the other side has a bunch of arguments which show that your evidence is wanting, then you have to abandon that belief. Or better yet, before making a judgment, read the pro, read the con, and then decide whether the preponderance of evidence goes in a certain direction. Yeah, do you have your hand up?
What if you have a belief in something and you have sufficient evidence for it, and then something new comes up and you find out that, okay, maybe what you thought was correct, is that still part of that, like, stain that can never be wiped away? Like, speed of light. We used to think, oh my God, we can't pass the speed of light. Speed of light, you know, is the fastest it can go. And then the hydrogen collider made that wrong. We found out we can actually go faster than that. We had a belief that speed of light was the quickest. Mm-hmm. Is that, like, a stain that can never be wiped away?
I think Clifford might say something like that. The best evidence at any given time is going to depend on the historical circumstances.
Okay.
So he might agree that the belief that speed of light is a constant and an absolute might be justified before you built the collider, assuming that it's proved that the speed of light is no longer an absolute. I think there's some debate about that still.
It is debated, but it's been recreated multiple times now.
And so when you're on the frontiers of physics, you know, things are sort of up in the air, and I think he would say probably you go with the best evidence and you proportion your belief with the evidence.
Okay.
So you might say, you know, certain things, you know, you might say, well, you know, like I'm trying to think of what would be like 90% certainty, like you might say, Kepler's laws and Newton's laws and so on. And then you'd say the Einsteinian stuff, maybe a little less. And you sort of, the idea is that you have sort of basic beliefs, and then you have these sort of peripheral beliefs that you might be more open to revision. So it's not just that you got wrong. So if you believe based on the best evidence, and any reasonable person would say that's probably true, then that's okay. What's wrong is to believe something that without any evidence at all, or with really poor evidence. Yeah, it's kind of a subtle distinction. But there can be cases where you're believing with the best evidence available to you. And not just like available to you, you know, as you're sitting here right now, but all the evidence you could have gotten if you'd gone out and investigated. And if you gather all that evidence, and still you say, oh, this seems like this is the best explanation, and any reasonable person would agree, then that's fine. And you might turn out to be wrong. But you're less likely to be wrong than if you just, like, wake up in the morning and you think, well, am I going to believe today? I'll believe I have possible things before breakfast. Yeah, I think I'll go on, I think it's some wacky website. I stopped picking on George Norrie for a while. I'm just trying to think of, I'll go to the Illuminati are here.com to read the latest on the doings of the Illuminati and the reptile men or what have you. Let's see what else about Clifford. Now, here's an interesting thing about Clifford. He says, your beliefs aren't your own business, that your beliefs aren't private, and that there's no such thing as a private belief. So your beliefs are not your own business is one thing he says, and then all beliefs are public. And why does he say this? Or what do you think he means by this? When he says your beliefs aren't your own business. Aren't I entitled to believe whatever I want?
There's other people that don't believe the same thing.
Does it go back to the ship owner thing? Does it affect people?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, what if I keep my beliefs to myself?
Your actions are reflected.
Yeah, it's really hard. If you really have a belief, your actions are going to follow it. So even if you're not going out trying to evangelize people, you know, if you're like, for example, if you're assume that religious beliefs are unjustified. If you're there, you know, praying over your meal in a restaurant, if you're wearing religious symbols on your, you know, on your person, and then maybe like a person would say, make some, you know, remark about religion, and then ask you and says something like, you don't go to church, do you? And then what are you going to do, lie? So, I mean, there are going to be some context in which your beliefs, whatever they are going to be spread. Or, you know, maybe a friend comes over and says, oh, what's the deal with the way your furniture is arranged? It's kind of novel. And you say, oh, yeah, well, it's this book on feng shui I was reading. It's the ancient, you know, art of furniture arrangement to get the qi to flow right or something. And so it's going to come out in some way. It's like if you're like a vegetarian, for example, if you think like meat is bad for you or eating large amounts of vegetables is good for you, and suppose you don't have any justification for that. There actually is really good scientific justification that shows that a diet high in vegetables and low or absent animal products is the optimum one for human health. But be that as it may, suppose you've never looked at a book. The reason you're like a vegan because it's part of some old book that you've got fixated on as a child. Maybe you're raised in a commune and you're raised to think that meat is murder and that meat is poison and that you'll die of E. coli and mad cow, and you have all these crazy health beliefs about why meat is bad, and you think that food dyes are going to poison your blood. And so you have all these beliefs, and so you're sitting there, you have your strict vegan diet, and you go out with some friends to a restaurant. I mean, what? You know, what are you going to do, right? You're going to order like the vegetable plate and probably ask some questions about and tell them not to put any salt in it. Make sure they're not going to fry it in like some meat oil or something like that. And so I mean, you're going to ask questions, or your friend, or people are going to look at you and like, do you want the rest of my steak, or you know, how come? What's to do with the vegetables? You on a diet? So it's going to come out eventually, in some way or other. And to, you know, maybe it's just like you're in the bar there, and you're looking at your horoscope, and somebody looks over and says, "Oh, what's your sign, man?" And you know, are you going to lie to them, or are you going to say, "Oh, I think astrology is bunk"? Or even more, like, what if you're in a conversation and someone starts sharing your kinky beliefs? Are you just going to keep your mouth shut, or are you going to say, "Well, that'd be really interesting if it was true, but is there really any evidence for that?" That sort of thing. And Clifford thinks you have a duty. Not just, you have a duty to support all your beliefs and also to speak up when somebody else starts sharing an unjustified belief. Yeah.
So do you, according to him, do you have the duty to yourself for that, society for that, or both?
I think he thinks you have a duty to society. So you might follow him on sort of the fact that he's kind of a collectivist, or he's like a belief communist. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can see him. He's sort of like, I mean, he is sort of a socialist with regard to belief. He thinks that the reason why you should justify your beliefs is because it's important for social progress and the progress of human civilization. Yeah. Yeah.
We can see a living example of this... basically what you're talking about through your personal sarcastic tone about the Illuminati or the reptilian men, you know, like it's your belief that is spoken through your speech, that like you may not like ascribe to these beliefs, but it's also about how you convey those beliefs of others that attest to your personal standpoint.
Yeah, I mean that's probably a good point. Maybe I'm being unfair to people that believe in the reptile man. Sometimes I want to see like how far down the rabbit hole people are willing to go, and they sort of say all these things and ask for evidence. I'm like, well, do you believe this? And I keep on going, and then it just keeps on. From my mind, you get farther and farther away. From what can be objectively proved, and then they send me a website that shows a picture of Prince Charles apparently having a slit pupil, and because they like the light's hitting him just right, and the idea is that he's like secretly, you know, that Prince Charles is an alien, and I look at like is there any objective evidence for this, and it seems like evidence is you know extremely wanting. So, but I mean, I agree with your point, though. I mean, you make a good point that it's really hard to try to be completely objective, even the way that you present things, because you pick anything and you say, well, you know, like, what if you believe in unicorns, and someone says, unicorns is part of my Celtic neo-pagan religion, and unicorns do exist, and, you know, and then, like, well, I mean, what are you going to do? It's like you say... If you say, well, you know, okay, you know, like how you got 10 fingers and somebody raises their hand and says, my uncle lost his pinky in an industrial accident, so he only has 9. Okay, well, this is the exception that proves the rule. So I mean, I agree that Clifford is right that your beliefs will, you know, come out and people will have an inkling of what you believe, even if you try really hard to hide it. So I mean, I suppose that's the one I would say to that. And I apologize if I offended anyone who has beliefs in the 9/11 conspiracy or the Illuminati or.
My uncle's a reptile guy.
But yeah.
I wanted to bring up a real quick question about: have you heard of Zachariah Sitchin?
Mm-hmm.
So Zachariah Sitchin.
Yeah, I've read his books.
So you're familiar with the work he's done with the Sumerian texts and like his whole work?
I am. I've read 3 of his books. I don't think that he knows Sumerian very well. I mean, I don't know. I don't know Sumerian at all, but I can look at his translations, and I look at the translations of mainstream scholars, and they're completely different. And I wonder, you know, what's going on there. And these are people, you know, at the universities who spent their lives studying the ancient texts, and I think Sitchin is largely self-taught on these things. And so I look at like people from University of Chicago, at the ancient Near East, you know, studies people, and people that read Akkadian and Sumerian and Babylonian. And they look at these texts, and they don't have translations about spaceships and the starmen and stuff. It's pretty much it's stuff that fits in with what we know about Sumerian culture.
So with this in mind, when we see stone tablets depicting scenes that may potentially be depictions of these like occurrences, isn't this tangible evidence for a belief system? More so than a written document that may have transpired 500 years after somebody's existence?
Well, like an example might be, this isn't from Sitchin, this is from Eric von Däniken. And he wrote this book called Chariots of the Gods, and he's got a couple of followers for it. And he's sort of one of the early pioneers of this theory. And so he has a picture of it's a Sumerian mural. I can't remember the name of this king now, not Sumerian. It's a Mesoamerican mural. I think it's Aztec, or maybe it's Toltec. And it's got this guy, and he's reclining in a chair, and he's got a long tube, and he's holding it up to his lips, and underneath there's sort of something that looks sort of like fire. And he's got on this like weird looking headgear. And Eric von Däniken says, well, look, this is a spaceship, and there's the flames coming out of the bottom. It's like a rocket, and that's like his breathing apparatus that he needs when he's going up into space. But if you look at what within the cultural context, what's a more likely explanation, and you can find other carvings where you see people toking on pipes, and they have this long sort of pipe. It's like a hookah, right? And you see these sort of floral designs of flowers that other places, which where the flames doesn't make sense, and you see this design elsewhere, and it seems these are just ornamental flowers. And then you see this headgear, and you see at other places where you don't see people reclining on the couch, but it's like another context, and it looks like it's a ceremonial headdress. And you look at the descendants of people like that, and you see they're wearing this sort of feathered headgear with all sorts of stuff dangling on there. And so in the cultural context, it makes more sense to say that these are things that are part of the culture. You'd need some extra evidence to show that it's part of this this is a sign of an extraterrestrial. And so I think that's probably what Clifford would say. And we might go back and forth in the case here, and there might be, again, arguments about a particular case, what the best evidence is. So I think, and to keep this sort of philosophical, Clifford would say, you shouldn't like assume that things are a certain way. But there are certain things like Occam's razor that says the simplest explanation is usually the one that's the true explanation, the best one. And that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Now, if you have some extraordinary evidence, then you go to the extraordinary claim. But if it fits in with just sort of everything we know about archaeology, you go to the simplest, most naturalistic explanation, and only jump to something beyond if you have additional evidence. I'll make sure to that we finish off Clifford at least today. We have an abbreviated week because Monday was a holiday. So what would Clifford say about innocuous beliefs and harmless superstitions? Again, he thinks that your beliefs are going to have some effect some way, and it's really hard to keep them to yourself. And even on the tone of voice you use, an offhand remark, people are going to draw conclusions based on that. I think, let me look at next week here, because we have religious knowledge next week. I might want to introduce James here. So William James, in his essay, The Will to Believe, actually quotes Clifford. So you'll see him commenting on Clifford's view here. And basically he agrees with Clifford overall, but he says there are some cases in which you have the right to exercise a will to believe.
So James
generally agrees with Clifford. You know, but you have a right to exercise a will to believe. You have the right to exercise the will to believe without sufficient evidence. If three conditions are met. So you have an option between or among beliefs. You try to choose from between or among several beliefs, perhaps, and it has to meet these. In order to believe without sufficient evidence, it has to meet these three conditions. And the option has to be living. It has to be, is in order here. Living, forced, and momentous. So a living option is one that's really open to you, and this is something you could really believe, that you're able to believe. And James is sort of a realist here. The example he gives is a Muslim's not going to believe that sprinkling holy water on you is good for you, and that because holy water is like a Catholic thing, so they're not going to want the priest to sprinkle the holy water on them because they're a Muslim. And so the idea is that if you're raised a Muslim, your choice is believe in Islam or believe or don't believe. But it wouldn't be like believe in Catholicism because you're
forced,
probably
right?
What's that?
That's forced.
No, it's a living option to believe in Islam if you're raised in a Muslim culture. If you're raised in a Catholic culture, say you're raised in Latin America, your choice is believe in Catholicism or believe in nothing. So that's sort of the way, given your culture and the way you're raised, you have certain options. And it might be too that if you're raised maybe by atheist parents, maybe it wouldn't be a living option for you to believe in religion if your parents raised you to think religion is superstitious nonsense.
Yeah. So it's just accepting a cultural norm, is that really what that is?
A living option is one where you really have a choice to believe. It's really possible for you to believe one thing or another. That you aren't so conditioned by your culture, experience, and upbringing that you really couldn't believe that thing. So in other words, it has to be a choice you can make between two beliefs. Like, if you're raised to, like, for example, I can't choose to believe that Abraham Lincoln was a vampire hunter because I know too much about history and I know too much about, vampires. Vampires don't exist. I'm living in the modern world. There's no evidence that vampires exist. And also, I know a lot about Abraham Lincoln, and there's no evidence that he had any belief in vampires or hunted vampires or could chop down a tree with a single blow of an axe. All right? So that's not a living option for me, believe Abraham Lincoln was a vampire or believe that he wasn't. So that's an example of a dead option. So the opposite is a living option. And for me, based on my experiences, it might be something like, growing up in America, it might, like, you're a multicultural society, it might be, be an atheist, believe in kind of Judaism or Christianity, or maybe have a generic belief in God or something like that. Or maybe go like Eastern religions, because particularly if I grew up here in Eugene or had a lot of interaction with Eastern religions. But the idea is it's not a living option to me to believe in like witch doctors, for example, or that somebody putting on a scary mask and shaking a rattle and can scare away the, and give in a magical incantation, can scare the evil spirits out of somebody and cure them of a disease, or to believe that diseases are caused by evil spirits. It's not like I could actually form that belief, because it's just
grow up in the modern world, it's not a living option. A forced option is one where you have to make a choice right now. You can't put it off. And if you don't make that choice right now, you're going to lose something. And an example of a forced option is, do you take your umbrella today? Assuming you carry an umbrella, you either take it out with you or you leave it at home. And when you're about to walk out the door, you have to decide, am I going to pick up the umbrella? Am I going to leave it at home? You look at the sky, and you pay your money, you take your choice. But you have to decide then. You can't decide when you're like halfway to school in the car, you know, you can't decide to take your umbrella because it's not, you don't have the choice anymore. And if you end up getting wet, you know, by the time you get to school, it's definitely too late if you have to head to class, and then you have to decide. Then you can't, your choice is gone, right? And you either get wet or you don't. And then momentous just means it's really important. It's going to have some big effect on your life. So the umbrella thing, it's forced but not momentous, right? You have to decide whether to take your umbrella, but it's not a big deal if you get wet on the way to school. And you can have momentous but not forced. There might be some really big important decision that you can kind of put off for a while and you won't miss any opportunity and nothing particularly bad will happen. Like maybe writing the great American novel. Could I write the great American novel? Like if you don't start next month, doesn't mean the opportunity is gone. You can start anytime you want. But, you know, this is something that, like, want to be a writer might be a big decision in your life, might have a big effect on you, but it's not a force. So it'd be momentous. It's not a forced option. So it's momentous, but not forced. Yeah.
So again, momentous is something you have to do right now.
No. Momentous is really important.
It's really important, but not necessarily imminent.
It depends on whether it's also forced. Forced means you have to decide now. You know, or lose something. Lose some opportunity. There's going to be a cost attached to not deciding now.
What about momentous, though?
Momentous means that it's really important, but you don't lose anything by not deciding now.
Unless it's combining forces.
Right. In order to be forced or momentous, it also has to be living. I mean, if you're going to make that decision, you have to be able to make the decision. And the question is, do you have to make it now? And then, is it really important? And James says, if it fits all three of these criteria, then you can decide without sufficient evidence. It's okay to decide without sufficient evidence, to believe without sufficient evidence. Otherwise, you need sufficient evidence. Yeah.
So those that went to the position, that force?
That's a different kind of force. We're just talking about belief. Force that you have to decide. It's something you're trying to make a decision of your own free will.
Oh, okay.
And whether you should exercise your will to believe without sufficient evidence. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about this next time and move on to religious knowledge.